Welcome to The Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm Joel Harrison, joined as always by Dave Taylor, and we are still coming to you from the pandemic. So if you're listening to this in the future, yes, we were there. We survived. We were present for it all. Now, this does, at the point we're in New South Wales, Australia, though, we are allowed to see people. And I actually have seen Dave now a couple of times, which has been just magical, just lovely. But I did notice that Dave has gone on a health kick. He's one of these people who has, and during the pandemic, has decided that he's going to like come out looking like Adonis.
Oh, thanks, Joel. It's very sweet of you.
But he can't go to the gym, which, as we know, is a saturated evil. So instead, you've just been kind of like cutting. You've been doing like cutting out all foods. You're just a no foods guy.
Do you really want to know what the secret is? Do you want to know how I got these scars? I've gone gluten free. I think that's part of it, which just means I can't eat very much because everything is awful.
Become one of those people.
Yeah. But we've been going on kind of a long walk every day, and that's actually all it is.
Yeah.
And, okay. And I'm carrying all this weight in my beard now.
I started running.
Oh, gross.
I know, it really is. It's super gross. But we were on the FaceTime to friends in the UK, and Kate made reference to me being slothful. And so I thought, maybe I should do something. Start running. Gosh. It was just a nudge in that direction.
We started doing Couch to 5K a few years ago. That was my first, but it was like that was like when I was doing absolutely no exercise at all. And I was at peak post-grad thesis writing weight. And that was awful. That was just the worst thing I've ever done.
Yeah, well, we're going to come out of this pandemic looking probably much the same, actually, because, you know, as you can tell by our Dave's, I did couch to 5K and then it suddenly stopped. So we are people who operated cycles on these things. What did Dave get me to read this week? Well, maybe he's psychologizing me, because he got me to read an essay by C.S. Lewis called The Inner Ring, and it's all about social climbers and people who are trying to make it into the clique and stuff. And, you know, when he handed it to me, there was a little twinkle in his eye, a little wink, a little wink. So, Dave, was this your less than subtle way of trying to take a dig at me about something?
I can neither confirm nor deny. No. In a moment of sincerity here, I think you're the least likely to fall into this.
Yes. Yes, and thus by me celebrating, I'm indicating that in part I am likely to fall into this because it is something of a totalizing theory. But anyway, this essay, The Inner Ring by C.S. Lewis, what's it about?
Yeah, so The Inner Ring, it's an essay. You can find it in The Weight of Glory, which is, I think, a collection of essays. The Inner Ring, it was originally an address that Lewis made to a group of students at King's College on some sort of memorial day. I think it was in 1944. And in it, he's talking to a group of students, I think predominantly young men, about to enter into the workforce. And he's trying to impart to them a simple moral lesson that I think is still, while it's very simple, and it's a very short address, and a very simple point being made, it's nonetheless incredibly profound and I think really, really important. And I think he was spot on to latch onto this as something to talk to people kind of initiating a working life. So he's trying to encourage his listeners to avoid the temptation to allow one's life to become dominated by a desire to make it into the ruling clique or into the what he describes as kind of the informal power structures that exist within every subculture and social institution. Now, when he's saying these things, when he's kind of rejecting the idea that we should long to belong to this kind of inner clique, he's not being anti-hierarchical. He assumes that in a functioning meritocracy, a class of experts will naturally emerge. So the existence of what he calls an inner ring is not itself bad. Rather, he acknowledges that, he acknowledges three things really. Firstly, that making it into the inner ring is not the same thing as achieving excellence. And that's something that people often kind of conflate, that if you are in the group of people in the know within a given institution or profession, that that's the same as excellence. And he says that's not the case at all. Secondly, that our aim in life should actually be to be doing good work. So our goal in life, our teleology, our telos, shouldn't be merely acceptance into an inner circle, but we should actually be seeking kind of integrity and excellence for its own sake. And that in itself should, in a functioning kind of social order, reap rewards as far as recognition goes. And finally, and most importantly for the essay, we can miss out on life's deepest pleasures, particularly those of friendship, by seeking to make it and letting that desire dominate our entire existence. So the idea of the inner ring, Lewis kind of gets from a passage in War and Peace by Tolstoy, and he begins the address with this quote. I'm tempted to... Whenever I read this passage, my wife Sarah and I listen to a huge part of an audiobook of War and Peace. So on a very long car trip, and so I'm tempted to put those voices on, but I won't.
do you mean like Russian voices?
No. I won't say what. Yeah, no. It was this. There was. They'd always talk about Polonsky. It was really like, yeah. Anyway, so the quote is, or the passage rather is, when Boris entered the room, Prince Andrei was listening to an old general wearing his decorations, who was reporting something to Prince Andrei with an expression of servility on his purple face. All right, please wait, he said to the general, speaking in Russian with a French accent, which he used when he spoke with contempt. The moment he noticed Boris, he stopped listening to the general, who trotted imploringly after him and begged to be heard, while Prince Andrei turned to Boris with a cheerful smile and a nod of the head. Boris now clearly understood what he had already guessed, that side by side with the system of discipline and subordination, which were laid down in army regulations, there existed a different and more real system. The system which compelled a tightly laced general with a purple face to wait respectfully for his turn, while a mere captain like Prince Andrei chatted with a mere second lieutenant like Boris. Boris decided at once that he would be guided not by the official system, but by this other unwritten system. So Lewis takes this kind of as a model for the way in which institutions and social settings work. He discusses how these informal power or social structures exist in every institution or social group, and that they're never kind of overt, but instead they're invisible. He always talks about these, there's these invisible lines that we're in danger of crossing to become insiders or outsiders. And this kind of, the very fact that they're invisible lends to this group or this type of membership a certain level of mystique and allure.
So they're parallel structures, right? So yep. Parallel authority structures that are rule-based, but in the sense that perhaps the rules may be unwritten conventions mm-hmm. or based in etiquette. In a way, it's fascinating to read this because it's quite a totalizing theory, right? Every group has these unwritten rules and this inner circle of who is in and who is out based on them. You know, he gives the example of those who want to be part of high society, a member of high society, but there are, you know, others as well. So you want to be in the inner workings of the academic committee, you know, in the know of people who are shaping the, tacitly shaping the institution. Or he says about also being wanting to be part of the artist clique. So it's not just about exercising actual power, but being perhaps somebody who sits up in the loft with all the cool artists, right? And that made me think about how Because it's interesting what you said. I'm one of the least likely people to participate in this, but it's fascinating because it's such a totalizing theory that even the person who's a dissident, right,
yep,
or operates at the margins, as you know, some people like to frame their advocacy, especially say in Christian circles,
yep,
there is absolutely within that a desire to be an inner circle that is those who are the, you know, the professional protester, or yep, the activist, or the, you know, dissident, or the person in the margins, in which you are centered to that margin,
yep,
because you have become, you know, part of the inner circle there. You know, and I was just thinking about how, you know, we construct these various things in different contexts. So another example, I think, in contemporary setting would be when you read about, you know, progressive groups that have their own forms of etiquette or language rules that mean people can fall foul of what they didn't understand to be the most up-to-date version of those rules, right? So I think I sent this to you a while ago, a fascinating article about Instagram knitting communities,
yep,
in which they went through a purity spiral, which they started talking about diversity in knitting.
Yep.
And then that perpetuated more and more sort of claims of the need for recognizing diversity and various missteps that people were making, and then they were cast out and so on, right?
Yep.
You know, so it wasn't just about inclusivity. And so in ways, it's fascinating that, because what Lewis, I think, is arguing in this essay is that that sort of rulemaking, so by convention, means you lose sight of, as you said, the telos of a community or the ends to which that group is oriented. So in the knitting context, you know, they were there for good crafting and knitting that was, you know, welcoming all people into that craftsmanship. But then it turns into actually what this article described, I think quite rightly, as a spiraling purity culture.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I've seen it in kind of activist circles as well. So, you know, I've engaged in some light activism over the years around especially kind of refugee stuff and climate stuff. And one of the struggles of organizers is that, you know, part of the goal is to form alliances, and particularly forming alliances with working class people who may not have the kind of, I don't know how to describe, you know, the right values kind of thing around
it. Or not just working class, right? But also you, weren't you just a bit too much of a nerd for it?
Oh, man. I won't go into that one.
I mean, all those book learnings, what's Zach doing for you?
Yeah, there was actually a couple of times where I was at protests and I got...
But I had that. I remember that actually. I remember being friends with people who lived in intentional communities.
Yeah.
And the constant refrain was, what's the point in what of anything that you're doing?
Yep.
You know, you can't be truly radical or anything, because you're just this trumped up intellectual type.
Okay.
You know, you're not doing the real deal.
Are they all middle class property owners?
Of
these
course,
days?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, awesome.
But like, you know, it's fascinating, right? You create these inner circles, these sort of that, you know, these demands upon what the demands upon whether you can be in or out as a circle of friendship or not.
Yeah. Anyway, I'd love to talk about now why I think that you don't fit with this system, but maybe I'll bring it up at the end. Well,
okay.
the spoiler for this is that I think because you have no filter.
Yeah.
So you always say exactly what you think at all times, and your main thing is that you alienate everyone around you because of it.
Yeah, good. Yeah, it's the way God intended.
So getting back to the essay though, what's wrong, according to Lewis, with this desire to be on the inner ring, apart from the obvious reasons that we've already talked about? So firstly, Lewis observed that it can lead to us to a kind of deadening, ruthless careerism or an impulse towards excluding others so that we might be able to get ahead. And that's a pretty obvious one. So if there's no space within the inner ring because kind of the value of the membership rests in its exclusivity, we'll do everything that we can to undercut existing members or to make sure once we're in, others don't get in as well. So that's part of the problem. It leads to this kind of corruption of the soul. But secondly, and I think much more interestingly, Lewis sees it as leading to this kind of emptiness and meaninglessness in those who are consumed by this desire. And I'll quote Lewis again. He says, "The torture allotted to..." do you know this word, Joel? Danaids? D-A-N-A-I-D-S.
Just roll with it.
Danaids in the classical underworld, that is, of attempting to fill sieves with water, is the symbol not of one vice.
It's sieves.
Sieves. Do you know what it is?
The Greek words I can excuse. The English words I won't.
Let's start that again. The torture allotted to Danaids in the classical underworld, that of attempting to fill sieves with water, is the symbol not of one vice, but of all vices. It is the very mark of a perverse desire that it seeks what is not to be had. The desire to be inside the invisible line illustrates this rule. As long as you are governed by that desire, you'll never get what you want. You are trying to peel an onion. If you succeed, there'll be nothing left until you conquer the fear of being an outsider you will remain. So Lewis observes that the desire to be on the inner ring has no end in the sense that it has no teleology, no telos, but it also goes on ad infinitum. Once we gain a certain level of prestige and membership to the group that the prestige affords, we long for more, and so we're apt to kind of disdain our new found friends as we look to the next level. This point points to a theme that I found immensely formative in Lewis's work, that sin, I think rightly understood, is its own punishment. So for Lewis, the status-obsessed careerist who instrumentalizes all of their relationships as a means of, so treats their friendships or relationships as means to get ahead, will reap only loneliness as their reward. And this is such a important idea that I got from Lewis, actually. And if you want more on it, I think All of the Great Divorce is a meditation on this, but also The Weight of Glory itself, that essay, is all about this. So the problem with sin is not just that it's a breaking of rules. It is a corruption of human essence. So once we become less than truly human, we become these kind of shadows or wraiths. So God himself, and this is the meaning of glory in Hebrew, it means weightiness, solidity. And once we cease to kind of participate in the divine nature, we lose our essence. And so sin itself is a punishment as well as a crime.
So it's also, I mean, Rowan Williams talks about this and is, you know, what is it? Christ, the heart of creation, right? You know, he says, what is truly divine is also truly human.
Yeah.
So as in if we truly do human things, then we are truly participating in the divine as well. So in this case, for Lewis, he's saying that the clamoring to be in the inner circle and those inner circles of the inner circles is not truly human, whereas what is truly human is to pursue the good that is attendant upon some activity, some practice. So the virtue of an academic life is to pursue an understanding of the truth, right? Something like that, as opposed to the virtue of it being to get yourself on the inner circle of the inner circle of the committee, of the committee, right?
Or move to the next more prestigious institution and then become a part of the inner circle there.
Right. Interesting. So, or if you take it in a church context, it's not just about, you know, being on the inner circle within a church, but it's about then being on the inner of synod, being on the inner of the standing committee, being of the inner and so on, right? And it's kind of reflects a clamoring not just for recognition, which is a good as well, but also for a certain sense of like power, right?
Mm.
To shape that institution. And that's an interesting point as well, right? That he's also, what this reflects as well, I think, is that sort of that idea as well that what can be evil is just kind of a perversion of something that can be good.
That's right.
Right. So in this case, you wanting to get into the inner circle, maybe because you want to shape things or because you want to have some form of recognition, right? I think this is incredibly the case in both academia and ministry.
Yeah.
There's this constant
drive and desire for recognition.
Yep.
And then you see the ways it gets perverted.
Yeah.
Right? It gets perverted in the academic context when people are constantly, you know, telling others that they need to be citing their work or, or you know, you go to conferences or job talks for those who are applying for jobs and they're just really a rendition of that person's own outlook, as in the person doing the questioning, their own outlook, you know, their own trying to find their own space in order to get other people to recognize that they should be, you know, someone who should be listened to.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that happens in church context as well, quite significantly.
Oh, absolutely. And but we have an extra layer within ecclesial settings because we can justify our exclusion by saying that we're pursuing purity in doctrine or protecting people's souls and things like that. And so we have these very convenient masks for this process of trying to find our place in the inner ring. But maybe we'll move on to that towards the end. But I think that's a very important point, especially the idea that vices are virtues that are in some way out of order. Mm. Because Lewis insists that the inner circle is not a problem. And he uses an example of, you know, if you have a pious grandmother or aunt, I can't remember what the example is, who is suffering and coming to the end of her life, a peaceful death for her is a good, but wishing that your aunt would die is bad. And it's all about the kind of attitude of our soul towards it.
So he then goes on to say that you must try and break your desire for this inner ring.
Yes. So he says the quest for the inner ring will break your hearts unless you break it. But if you break it, a surprising result will follow. If in your working hours you make the work your end, you'll presently find yourself all unawares inside the only circle in your profession that really matters. You'll be one of the sound craftsmen, and other sound craftsmen will know it. This group of craftsmen will by no means coincide with the inner ring or the important people or the people in the know. It will not shape that professional policy or work up that professional influence which fights for the profession as a whole against the public, nor will it lead to those periodic scandals and crises which the inner ring produces, but it will do those things which that profession exists to do and will in the long run be responsible for all the respect which that profession in fact enjoys and which the speeches and advertisements cannot maintain.
I think this is fascinating because it's true, right? It's saying that you should pursue the vocation of being a good craftsman and good will flow from that, right? Or just you'll gain, and in fact, he's suggesting recognition will flow from that because other craftsmen will recognize you and so on. And that is true, but it requires a certain, requires a considerable degree of humility for starters.
Yep.
And then also there is kind of just the question about, you know, how much is this a burden just simply to the individual? You just got to change your mindset and just practice your craft, right?
Yep.
When you think about, well, actually we're under pressures that are created by these inner circles. So, you know, the inner circle then directs that we must do X.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we all now must do it, right? So I can't just be a craftsman in the way that, say, Lewis is suggesting, which always has that echo of the Oxford Don or the Cambridge Don, right?
Well, yeah. And I think that leads to kind of, I think, where we'll wrap up this conversation. Like, there are now social structures. So Lewis is absolutely right. And there would have been pressures in his time to conform to that inner ring kind of mindset. And there were structures in place in his time, but I think we're in a whole new world at the moment in that we have set up industries and vocations and things like that with structures that necessitate the type of vice that he is describing. So I think you're right. It's harder to escape the pull towards the kind of vice that he's describing certainly in professions like academia, from what I understand.
So and so what I think that means is that you know, a lot of the inner circle sometimes is established, and then it becomes a perpetual motion machine because it's almost becomes a life. It becomes the thing itself, what it does.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's recent writing from an economist out at LSE about bullshit work.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
You know, the work that actually has no real meaning upon it, but just sort of, like I said, becomes the thing itself. It becomes a thing that becomes focused on rather than anything actually productive.
Yeah.
So constant Zoom meetings at this point in time, for example, in order to show your face, to show that you're part of this inner circle, right?
Because someone's job is to make sure you're doing that, even though that's unnecessary. But that job in itself might not be necessary, but the person has to perform that function, even though it has no good end.
And then you have to be part of it in order to show that you're playing the game, or you're part of it, right?
Yeah.
I think this happens in multiple contexts. I don't think it's just in academic circles and so on, but the ways in which we become distracted by something that becomes then the thing itself. So, you know, I'll create a new policy and I'll become like the new policy maker in a business, right?
Yeah.
I will engage in professional aspects of professional development, like making my workers do constant personality quizzes, you know, about what kind of worker are you, and you know, what kind of various HR things, right? As opposed to actually the productive work that this thing is designed for, that this industry or this vocation is oriented to.
Yeah.
And there's something there about, I think, how certain personality types really gravitate towards that.
Oh yeah.
And I think this goes to, you know, to go to your, you know, Joel's not maybe an inner circle kind of guy. I mean, undoubtedly there are elements of it, because I do think there'd be a bit of the, oh, you know, like I said, the dissident or the person who's being provocative or the person who's writing polemically wants to be sort of inner to those polemics, right? But I think where it comes down to is actually what Lewis points to here as an antidote to this is actually conviction.
Yes.
Right. And conviction that something has a purpose, right? And that, so the university has a purpose, and we should all be, our friendship should be based around a shared conversation about that. So Lewis in The Four Loves talks about friendship as asking the question, do you see the same truth as me?
Yeah.
Well, he's not saying like, do we agree on something? He's saying, do you even see the same question as me? Do you see the same purpose, right? And this made me think of, you know, you were discussing with us the other day, something that just made me really think about a definition of narcissism is not, you know, narcissism, as you were explaining, you should take over, but it's not just simply too much self-love, but it's a certain emptiness, right?
Yeah, that's right. That everybody is a means to fulfill the emptiness within yourself. So that's why narcissists can be incredibly charming and apparently loving in the initial stages of a relationship, because they need you. But what they need from you is to fill themselves up. And so very quickly, that relationship will turn into a source of kind of a consumption of you, which will never be filled, because inside them is this kind of black hole. And another part of it, and Lewis is very good on narcissism, actually. Lewis says that the opposite of that, humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. So actually taking yourself from the center of the universe and putting others into that center. Whereas not the narcissist, everything is about them. And so in kind of psychotherapy, we talk about the existence of fragile narcissists. So people that are full of shame and will always be talking about how rubbish they are. That doesn't mean that they're not a narcissist, because in that situation, it's still all about them. It's all about them and their shame and their inferiority and things like that. So anyway.
What I find interesting in that is that emptiness of lack of conviction, so that the person can become a chameleon.
Yeah.
You know, a chameleon in the sense that they will shift their arguments, ideas, and personality based on the context they're in. So this, to link it to this inner circle, it's this idea that you could be talking to the same person, and if they're talking to someone of the inner circle or trying to get into that, they will be a totally different person to then who they talk to.
Because they're
just
a mask. So there's nothing behind. There's nothing behind them. And this gets to why I wanted to talk about this essay or this, because we don't often do just moralism on the Eucatastrophe. We're a political theology podcast predominantly. So why would we talk about this? And it's because I think that we live in a society that's conducive to this kind of vice, because for a whole set of developments in our intellectual and cultural furniture, we have lost a sight of life institutions and vocations as having a teleology. Nothing has that. When we say teleology, we mean things being orientated towards an actual purpose. There's an endpoint that, or a purpose to them. So every week, Joel says that we're here to investigate true human ends and how life might be enchanted. And part of living in a disenchanted world is being in a world without ends. And I think the reality that you're describing, Joel, is what will naturally emerge in a society that has no end. So academia, once kind of traditionally understood, existed for a purpose. And that was, there was a theological purpose behind it as well, but it was also about the accruing of knowledge and expertise and then the dissemination and the use of that knowledge for the good of humanity. So that was the purpose and goal of it. But today, the university doesn't seem to have that purpose. It exists for its own sake. And so the whole institution and the centers of power within it exist to kind of simply exist and to expand.
I would say it's complex. I mean, there are obviously pockets that still understand themselves in those traditional ways, right? But you create a complex society, essentially, that then has within it circles within circles within circles, right? Yeah. And some of those circles are fundamentally oriented towards something else, which is, you know, maybe the perpetual power games of individuals and things like this. I mean, I think of this in the context of ministry as well. Like you and I talk about this, about how wonderful it is when you meet a parish priest who understands their vocation as a parish priest.
Yes. Yep.
You know, and understands that their job is to minister to the sick, the dying, those in need, to build up a community, to, you know, witness to that, to witness to God's love and so on within that space, as opposed to, you know, trying to climb up ranks of supposed social recognition.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think that as in academia and in ministry, that there's kind of an attitude that develops where the work that I'm doing right now is only instrumentally valuable. So the thing that I have in front of me to do is only there so that I can do it to a satisfactory degree, so that then I can move on to the next thing. I think this is part of this kind of existential crisis of our culture, where we no longer value the work that is in front of us, and so we have this deep sense of meaninglessness. And this is kind of reflected, this kind of lack of value in the work in front of us is reflected in the fact that people don't stay in jobs anymore, because their work exists in order to facilitate consumption or advancement or the next the bigger house.
I'd go deeper as well and say, because people understand that in a purposeless world, that fundamentally our discourse is about power.
That's right.
It's about who's in, who's out, who's, you know, part of that, you know, that purity spiral we mentioned before, who's going to use the power to exercise it over others, and how do we, you know, how do I gain that and how do I use it, sort of thing. In which case, you know, then you're outside of any shared conversation about what is the end that we are committed to.
And for this reason, I think one of the side effects of this is that professions and institutions lose expertise. So people don't stay in a position long enough to really get to know what it means to be ex-profession. And because everyone's always moving around. And so the substitute that our society creates for a loss of expertise through experience is we create a consultancy class or that comes in and substitutes for experience gained through years of expertise gained through years of experience. So I think, you know, I'm sure you wouldn't find this happening in the university at all, Joel.
I was just thinking about Lewis's antidotes to this. He talks about essentially, I mean, you could think about you actually need people with conviction, right? Yeah. So people who actually understand that there is a truth to be pursued or there is, you know, and that is the basis for your craftsmanship to develop a vocation and so on. You know, instead of being, you know, grey men and women who just are sort of blank slates that will be chameleons and change their views depending on what power politics are going swirling around them, right? Yeah. So he has that. And so that means actually being someone who, that's where you, when you said, oh, Joel, you're not probably someone like that. I think it's because of that, right? I find that incredibly difficult when I encounter someone like that because I'm someone who thinks that, you know, convictions matter and that actually that's the basis for us having our conversation with each other, right? So, but then there is, so he does have this about, you know, digging deep into your vocation and so on. There is always that element of me when I read Lewis where I think this just does sound like an Oxford or Cambridge don who's taking his life experience and turning into human nature, right? So when in the Four Loves, he talks about, you know, basically how wonderful it is to find someone who you can have a shared friendship with over, you know,
the Hunting Lodge or something like
that? Yeah, exactly. At the Hunting Lodge, right? Yeah. Like as a sort of at the Hunting Lodge.
Is that
lodge
where he talks about like the awkwardness when a woman comes in?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's this idea that, you know, you and I, we share a love on an object. And so that's the basis for our friendship, you know, and he has this point where he says, you know, and it doesn't matter then, you know, that say Dave is married, you know, and has all these other relationships and because we share, you know, the Hunting Lodge or we share the book club or we share the
this. A bit Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah. And I kind of at this point go, okay, like there, I mean, we need to complicate this picture a little bit, I think, because actually being friends with someone, I think, is being friends with their attended network of relations and so on.
Yeah.
And there is a component of like also me stopping and thinking, well, does friend, you know, especially when we talk about, you know, the eye needs the ear and the hand and the and the mouth and so on, that actually maybe our common object isn't as narrowly defined as maybe Lewis puts forward. Maybe there is actually a place for, no, you need difference as well within friendship of some kind.
Yeah. So like, yeah, and I think the way that we'll wrap up is maybe, I think here some points to reflect on about how to avoid being this type of person. So we've mentioned the word chameleon a few times. That's a word that we sometimes use to describe the kind of, I suppose every society has like its paragon of the social order. And I think in some ways, the chameleon is our example. So a chameleon is someone that just has no inner commitment to anything. They just, they change their opinion to suit their circumstances. And even within intellectual circles, this exists. And I find this, like you were saying, Joel, I find this incredibly frustrating. And I see it all over the place, especially on social media. People who, you just get the sense that none of this actually matters to them. And I, you know, I don't see myself as a paragon of intellectual virtue, but at the very least, coming to a position for me, I find incredibly painful. And it really keeps me up at night. And to see people who just kind of flit between ideas or their commitments are simply just them finding their niche or cornering their market because I have X intellectual or ethical or political commitment, which, you know, they flip between to suit their circumstances. This is at worst,
writing to the gatekeepers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I think the problem with them is that they become fundamentally uninteresting people, because they'll never they'll never let you push back against them and interrogate their ideas because there's no commitment there. And this is why I think you're actually different, Joel, because there are people that you deeply and fundamentally disagree with that you nonetheless have a lot of respect for, which is something that I don't often see in other people.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's a kind of like, it's like the hate follow, isn't it?
Anyway, so basically, I think the way to remedy this is to actually try to find work or something to do or produce in your life that you actually value for its own sake or for the social good that it fulfills. And it doesn't need to be employment or anything like that. But just do something because you think it's worthwhile. I remember one example that always haunts me that Lewis talks about. I can't remember where. Oh, it's the Screwtape Letters. He talks about one of the temptations that the devil should use is to make sure that the person that they're tempting is always trying to read the right books. And he talks about how never is the devil's work in more peril than when he sits down to read a book that he actually wants to read. I always think about it because I'm someone that works very hard because of my delayed education to be reading, making sure that I read the good books. But nonetheless, I think, you know, that's something to pursue. And also just there is a deep virtue, especially in the age of social media, to have less opinions and to not feel the need to fill silence with your own, and this is strange coming from someone that does a podcast on these things, but to not feel the need to treat silence as an opportunity to just say a semi-constructed thought or bit of ideology.
Well, that's let's finish. But that's just that's an interesting thing because it's about, you know, you can also be signaling to the gatekeeper. So a lot of church discourse is just simply manning your own ramparts, yep. Right? Signaling to the right people that you're in the know and you're in the right crowd and yep. Therefore, you know, and that happens regardless of where you sit, right? So like I said before, those who see themselves as dissidents and on the margins and so on, they have their very strong versions of this, right? But actually also the speaking as well is in and of itself a way of ensuring you maintain yourself in a circle because then you're constantly in people's heads.
Yeah, that's right. You know,
so this is the Donald Trump phenomenon, right? He tweets his thoughts and everyone's like, oh my gosh. And then it becomes entire news articles, yep. Right? I mean, it's genius to keep yourself constantly the topic of conversation. So you're constantly there. So it's not just about, you know, the immorality of just simply spouting off an opinion that is not formed,
yeah,
but it's about actually people do this strategically and structurally to ensure that they maintain constant presence.
Yeah, that's right. And that you know, and I think there's that this happens everywhere where N.T. Wright always used this phrase where he says when the problem with being a theologian is that people want you to say everything all the time. So the assumption is that if you're not saying every single bit of orthodoxy, people assume that you're not orthodox. And this happens with everything. So with progressive politics, for example, your silence speaks volumes if you don't make sure you're constantly saying the right, signaling to the right. Well, you know, I hate the phrase virtue signaling, but you're not signaling the right social and political orthodoxy. There is a real resistance to be had in actually, in some ways, not feeling the need to say something all the time. And the same thing is done with theology as well. If you're not always asserting X, Y, and Z theological position, that must mean that you don't have it and things like that. And I think in this, one of the ways that we can resist this culture is actually by thinking before we speak. Which is probably a banal place to end the episode, but we probably do need to finish it up here. Even though I've heard from numerous people they like the longer episodes, but we're old and tired.
People are going to start commuting again, so
yeah,
we'll have to reduce it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we should probably wrap it up there. Thanks so much for listening to this kind of mini two-part reflections on essays. I hope you've gotten something out of them. We had a lot of fun doing it. Thanks so much for the feedback we've gotten recently. A few people have dropped us reviews on the Facebook page. That's very lovely. A few people have shared us around. Thanks so much for doing that. Yeah, please keep reviewing us, keep sharing us around, and please like us on Facebook. You can find us by searching The Eucatastrophe on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at UCAT. EUCAT underscore podcast.
Words and spelling are hard today.
I'm having a really rough week. Leave me alone. I say that every single time we record this as well.
Yeah, you're good. You're doing great. Keep going. Keep going.
Thanks so much for joining us. And we'll talk to you next week as we lament over the fate of our beloved Star Wars franchise. I will see you then. Bye.